This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, December 18th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as the community of Newtown, Connecticut continues to mourn victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting, advocates call for more resources for mental health services. Leaders in Washington indicate some progress on budget crisis talks, but activists express concern about the details. And we go to Cameroon, where gay rights advocates face dangerous conditions in their fight for equality. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Dick's Sporting Goods suspended sales of modern sporting rifles nationwide today in response to the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. 20 first graders and 6 adults were killed at the school. At the store closest to the Newtown, Connecticut school, all guns are off the shelves. There's no word how long the measures will be in place. Cerberus Capital, a major private equity company, said today they'll sell off a company that makes Bushmaster weapons, one of which shooter Adam Lanza used in the rampage. And Michigan Governor Rick Snyder vetoed a bill that would have allowed guns at schools and in daycares. White House spokesperson Jay Carney announced that President Barack Obama is heartened by overtures from Republicans who say they are ready to discuss gun control. Further, he spoke to specific measures.
Well, he is actively supportive of, for example, Senator Feinstein's stated intent to revive a piece of legislation that would reinstate the assault weapons ban. He supports and would support legislation that addresses the problem of the so-called gun show loophole.
In the wake of the shootings, police departments around the country are increasing patrols at schools. From Los Angeles, Lena Nozizwe reports.
The Los Angeles Police Department plans to go to every elementary and middle school in the district every school day following the massacre of dozens, including 20 grade school students in Newtown, Connecticut. That is a substantial change in procedure that will mean stepped-up patrols for 540 schools within the district. Private and charter schools will also be included upon request. It's unclear how the move will affect police presence on other beats. In the past, when LAPD joined forces with school police, the focus was mainly on high schools. But Police Chief Charlie Beck says what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary has created a new reality. The uniform patrols will begin in the new year. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Two Kentucky schools were shut down today after a student wrote a letter claiming a classmate brought weapons to school and plotted attacks. Paducah's Reedland Middle and High Schools were both closed. The two share a campus. Officials say they won't reopen until they've evaluated the security threat. There was outrage both in and outside of India's parliament today amid calls for immediate measures to ensure women's safety. Bismillah Gilani reports that the protest follows the gang rape of a 23-year-old woman on Sunday night.
The rape victim is a student at a local college. She and a male companion were returning home when a group of about 6 men brutally attacked them and raped her in a private bus. The incident has triggered national outrage and protests from student groups. The parliament also reacted with shock. Lawmakers demanded tougher laws and severe punishment to deal with the rising cases of violence against women. Sushma Swaraj is leader of the opposition.
This is not an isolated case. Incidents like this happen every day, and the women who suffer this violence neither live nor die. They turn into a living corpse. So shouldn't the perpetrators of such crimes then be sent to the gallows?
India has seen an alarming increase in rape cases in recent years. According to the National Crime Records Bureau, more than 20,000 rape cases were reported in India in last year, more than 500 of them in Delhi alone. Analysts say an equal number of cases go unreported. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
In New Jersey today, labor activists tried to stop dock workers from unloading a ship carrying clothing made in Bangladesh and bound for Walmart. They want to prevent the retail giant from profiting off the deaths of sweatshop workers who died in a factory fire last month. Peter Rue has more.
Occupy Wall Street and labor justice allies sought to stop the crew of the Maersk Carolina from unloading garments in Elizabeth, New Jersey, that were headed for Walmart's nationwide this morning. 112 workers burned to death at the Tarzin factory in Dhaka on November 25th while making garments for the retailer. Mary Slokic is with New Jersey Communities United.
I have friends in Bangladesh. I have labor organizers and activists in Bangladesh. And it is imperialism and empire. And Walmart is the symbol of all of that.
Ultimately, it was up to the International Longshoremen's Association to make the call on whether to unload the cargo. But a heavy police presence prevented activists from making contact with ILA members, and eventually the ship delivered the goods. Organizers, however, have pledged to return in greater numbers. Peter Rue, FSRN, Elizabeth, New Jersey.
According to anti-death penalty advocates, 9 U.S. states killed 43 prisoners in 2012. That's the fewest states to carry out the death penalty in the last 20 years, a low reached only once before in 2008. And the number of new death sentences stayed below 100 for a second year in a row. Connecticut banned executions this year, but the federal government still imposes the death penalty. Yesterday, a federal judge in Connecticut delivered a death sentence to a man convicted of killing 3 people in 2005. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
In Newtown, Connecticut, funerals continued today as the community mourned victims of the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Attendees brought flowers and entered the St. Rose of Lima Church somberly this morning. The state chief medical examiner offered more details today on how Nancy Lanza, the mother of alleged shooter Adam Lanza, died, saying she died of 4 gunshots to the head from a .22 caliber rifle. Police say the investigation is ongoing and it could take months to piece together the story of what happened last Friday. Since the shooting, a growing number of people are publicly calling for a reassessment of mental health services and for more resources for parents and children. According to the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, states cut public mental health spending by more than $4 billion from 2009 to 2012. In Connecticut, the public mental health system provides coverage for less than 1 in 5 with a serious mental health problem, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. For more, we're joined by Kate Mattias. She's the executive director for NAMI Connecticut, and she joins us from Hartford. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Thank you for contacting me.
Funerals in the community of Newtown are taking place this week. Students are also returning to school. Begin with advice and resources you're offering to people in the community and in the region.
Certainly. We have a number of resources listed on our website, which is www.namict.org, that have to do with how to talk to children about traumatic events. We have information on our website about first responders and some of the resources they may need having had to deal with traumatic events. And we also have information related to adults who also have experienced traumatic events. So I think the first thing is to let people know that, in fact, these are traumatic events and that people will respond differently and that any response is really appropriate.
And that website, one more time?
Yes, I'm sorry. It's www.namict.org.
The Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law points out that people with mental illnesses are no more violent than people without mental illness. And we should also say that the details of this specific shooting are still coming out. The background and health conditions of the alleged shooter, Adam Lanza, are not known. But it has raised questions about mental health services and resources. How would you assess the services available to Connecticut residents today?
Well, Connecticut actually has a relatively rich array of mental health services. That being said, not all communities have access to all services. Transportation in some communities, especially our rural communities, can be a real challenge in terms of getting to services. I think also one of the big things that may stop, in particular, parents oftentimes from potentially getting their children the care that they may need is the stigma associated with mental illness. So you can have the most wonderful mental health system in the world, but if people feel bad about having to access mental health services because of the stigma associated with that, that can really prevent a lot of people from getting care. But we do know that 25% of the population will be impacted by mental illness in any given year. So we know that there are many individuals in the community who probably participate in mental health services, but we know we're not reaching everyone.
As you say, a quarter of the population impacted by mental health issues at some point. Talk about community-based services and how that differs from the treatment that has been used in recent decades.
Well, community-based services are really services that meet the person where they live. So having local mental health clinics, having individuals who might need housing support to provide low-income housing for them and wrap supports around them so that they can stay in their community, stay part of the community. What we know now about people with mental illness and recovery is that the more they're engaged in their community, the more they feel part of the community, whatever community that is, the better their prognosis, the better for all of us if we, you know, can normalize people with mental illness as just another person in our community who has a chronic disease or a chronic illness.
You also spoke about going to people and meeting them where they are. What about services available to youth or students through schools or other public venues?
Absolutely. We actually pushed very hard in the last legislative session here in Connecticut, along with a lot of other advocacy groups, to expand school-based mental health. We know that school-based health centers are really meeting kids where they are. There's a lot of information and research that shows that that's where a significant proportion of our kids are getting their mental health services is through schools. So we push to expand school-based health centers and with them the mental health portion of those. Unfortunately, some of that looks like it's now, it might be, the funding may be cut because of our budget travails here in Connecticut. But we know that that is something that works. That is an ideal community-based sort of care. And when you can use something like that and connect it with primary care also out in the community, you're looking at much better prognoses for a lot of children.
Kate Matthias is the executive director for the National Alliance on Mental Illness Connecticut. She joined us from Hartford. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A deal to avert the so-called fiscal cliff may be taking shape in Washington, D.C. In a meeting Monday with House Republican Speaker John Boehner, President Barack Obama offered to raise taxes on fewer wealthy Americans and accept deep cuts to Social Security and other programs. Though Boehner told reporters Tuesday the deal is not quite there yet, activists and some progressive lawmakers are already pushing back, saying they'd prefer no deal at all to one they see as fundamentally unfair. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Across from the Capitol building, hundreds of people from across the East Coast gathered to protest proposed cuts to the social safety net. After weeks of failed negotiations, President Obama agreed to the cuts as part of a compromise with Republicans. One demonstrator, Philadelphia resident Willie McRae, said it hurts him to hear elected officials use the programs he relies on as bargaining chips.
I'm dependent on those. That's my livelihood. And if all the cuts that they propose or do, it's going to hurt me naturally. You know? And I'm very angry about that.
At a meeting at the White House on Monday, President Obama presented his latest fiscal cliff counteroffer, which would raise taxes on families making more than $400,000 a year, abandon the payroll tax holiday altogether, and make cuts to Social Security benefits. Rebecca Thies with the Economic Policy Institute explained that the president agreed to what's called a chain CPI for Social Security and other benefits programs.
Which basically means those programs would rise less quickly because they'd be tied to a less generous measure of inflation, the ultimate result being that people would receive less and less, with each passing year.
President Obama campaigned on the promise to allow Bush tax cuts to expire on all households making more than $250,000 per year. In order to pay for raising that threshold to $400,000, he's now putting benefits on the chopping block that he previously said shouldn't be touched. Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin told FSRN this puts an unfair burden on the most vulnerable members of society.
Who made out like bandits in the last 10 years? The poor? Lower middle class? Single parent families? Homeless? No, they didn't make out in the last 10 years. The ones that made out in the last 10 years were upper income people who made out like bandits. Made huge amounts of money. Huge. Well, now it's time for them to start paying back a little bit. Not for those that didn't get anything in the last 10 years to give up even more.
Harkin said he'd be urging his Senate colleagues to vote against any deal that makes these cuts.
This agenda cannot be hijacked by this so-called manufactured cliff out there. I've said before, no deal is better than a bad deal.
Despite anxiety from progressives that the president has compromised too much already, Republicans say the offer and the benefits cuts aren't good enough. House Speaker John Boehner told reporters Tuesday that he's demanding what he calls a more balanced approach.
The White House offered yesterday was essentially $1.3 trillion in new revenues for only $850 billion in net spending reductions. That's not balanced, in my opinion.
In case the two sides can't reach a deal by January 1st, Boehner is proposing a backup plan.
So I believe it's important that we protect as many American taxpayers as we can. And our plan B would protect American taxpayers who make $1 million or less and have all of their current rates extended.
Though House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats say the bill would have no chance of passing the House and Senate, Speaker Boehner plans to bring it to the floor later this week. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
On Monday, December 24th, FSRN presents a special program, One Nation Under Surveillance.
You know, this is really a case at its core about the right of the public to know what the government's doing.
The U.S. government knows more than ever about its citizens, gathering data from aerial surveillance, phone conversations, and the internet.
We're collecting off of our Shadow Hawk color video. We can convert that to both, you know, still photographs or video.
You know, there are people who simply no longer want to communicate with us because they know the risk of surveillance is so much greater than it used to be.
Join us on Christmas Eve for our special program, One Nation Under Surveillance, a look back at our investigations this year on the legal and illegal spying mechanisms used by the government and private corporations, and the activists who are pushing back, demanding more privacy protections. That's Monday, December 24th on Free Speech Radio News. In Cameroon, an appeals court has upheld the sentencing of a man to 3 years in prison for being guilty of homosexuality. The offense, sending a text message to another man expressing his love. According to the AP, the 32-year-old man, Jean-Claude Roger Mabede, had already served a year and a half in prison and was released provisionally in July. The decision came Monday. He has 10 days to file an appeal. The ruling in Cameroon comes as lawmakers have introduced a new bill to the National Assembly that would criminalize same-sex marriage and strengthen existing laws against homosexuality. FSRN's Gala Killian Chimtom reports from Yaoundé.
Currently, at least four people are in prison for violating Section 347 of the Cameroon Penal Code. It's a controversial law that punishes sexual relations between people of the same sex with imprisonment for terms between 6 months and 5 years and with fines ranging from above $40 to $400. The Association for the Defense of Gays and Lesbians based in Cameroon says that in the past 4 years, police have arrested at least 51 people suspected of being gay. Prison guards and police often use violence against people accused of being gay, sometimes in order to extract confessions, according to Human Rights Watch. Yaoundé resident Vera Kiwo says she is discriminated against by both her family and the larger society.
When my parents discovered my sexual preferences, they looked devastated. They have disowned me. My brothers and sisters now treat me like an outcast. Friends treat me with so much disdain, I feel so lonely. But I've made my choice, and there is no going back. After all, it is my God-given right, isn't it?
The new bill introduced in the National Assembly would create harsher laws criminalizing sexual orientation. It would punish adults who engage in sexual activity with same-sex minors between 16 and 21 years of age with 8 years in jail. Those who have sexual relations with minors younger than 16 would be imprisoned for up to 15 years. LGBT advocates have criticized the draft, saying it equates youth homosexuality with pedophilia. Alice Nkom, a Cameroonian lawyer who represents people imprisoned for homosexuality, says that the penal code violates international law guaranteeing privacy and non-discrimination.
This provision in the penal code, 347b, is not a law. It is an ordinance the former president of the republic, Mr. Hijo, signed, violating the principle of separation of powers. This principle must not be violated by a country that pretend to be a democracy, because in democracy, separation of power is a must. So we are in the court to remove this law, which is unconstitutional and which is against all treaties, conventions Cameroon have signed.
Being an outspoken critic and activist has made Nkom the target of death threats. She says that she worries the threats are serious.
They say that we should stop it. If we don't, we will be killed, we will be raped.
Cameroon made headlines last summer when a national youth group known as the Cameroonian Youth Rally announced a new annual anti-gay day that includes a parade marching through the capital city. Some Yaoundé city dwellers recently took to the streets again to denounce all those who are gay.
First of all, it's abnormal. I think it's absurd. We should prevent God's anger from coming down on this country. If we don't say no today, we're going to say yes tomorrow. The Bible says, for the wages of sin is death. The wages of homosexuality is absolutely death.
That's an abomination, a terrible abomination. Our ancestors never knew that kind of thing. We have a culture that does not permit lesbianism. Each time I look at those kind of situations, I am forced to think that God is African.
Much of the country's homophobic rhetoric is driven by conservative religious philosophies. Cornelius Fontaine Essua is the Archbishop of Bamenda, the capital of the Northwest region of Cameroon.
The church is against homosexuality for the simple reason that it is against nature. God created man and woman as complement of one another. And homosexuality tells us that you can have a relationship, man and man, and woman and woman. In other words, the natural. One of the most strange things is that some homosexuals want to get children. How do they expect to get children? They want to adopt children. How can they adopt children? Whose children? How can they become real fathers and real mothers? It is against nature.
Despite this anti-gay environment and threats of violence, lawyer Alice Nkom says she will never fray from her resolve to defend human rights in the country.
They are innocent until they are condemned. We must defend them. Having a lawyer is a right for everybody when you have a trial in a court, when your liberty, when your freedom is in danger. As a lawyer, for 43 or 44 years, I defend everybody I want to defend who is in trouble with justice. Because everybody deserves to be defended.
She says if Cameroon passes legislation against gay rights, she will take the issue to the African Court of Human and People's Rights. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Today is International Migrants Day, and this year human rights advocates are focusing on man-made and natural disasters that put migrants in crisis situations they can't easily get out of. The economic crisis has also affected an estimated 200 million migrants around the world. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said in some countries, austerity measures discriminate against migrant workers, while xenophobic rhetoric encourages violence. For more, UN Radio's Patrick Maigua spoke to Jean-Philippe Chauzy with the International Organization for Migration.
Who is supposed to provide these migrants with help? Is it the governments where they have gone or their own host governments where they come from?
All hands on board are welcome when it comes to providing the return or the reintegration assistance. If you look at the Libyan crisis last year, yes, we were successful in evacuating about 250,000 stranded migrant workers from Libya, but many of them returned home to countries like Chad, Niger. Both countries last year received about 100,000 of their nationals. Those migrant workers were returning to areas that were facing food insecurity, areas where unemployment is endemic. Families were no longer benefiting from the remittances, the money sent by those migrant workers. So those countries and those families also need assistance. And there again, we are not very successful as the international community in mobilizing funds and focusing the attention on the needs of those migrants who are usually returning home empty-handed.
We have seen in many places, Libya, migrants were the first to be attacked. In the countries where there is a lot of economic crisis, migrants are being blamed for the economic crisis. Where does this leave migrants? Who is supposed to protect them?
Migrants, you're right, are usually stuck between a rock and a hard place. You mentioned Libya. Yes, migrants, even prior to the conflict last year, were having a very difficult time in Libya. Most of them were undocumented migrants, and therefore, without proper papers, without proper work contracts, they were very vulnerable to many forms of abuse. During the conflict, they were particularly stigmatized because of their perceived association to rebel groups that were fighting alongside the forces of Colonel Gaddafi. In Europe, too, the economic downturn, the increased unemployment rates, especially among young people in countries like Spain and Italy, unemployment rate for the year less than 25 in both countries, or in Greece is about 55-56%. This has basically reinforced stigmatization against those migrants. The current downturn means that there's very little understanding and very little appetite for migration, and migrants are, in Europe, very often stigmatized and made responsible for a situation for which they have nothing to do with. So again, a lot of public education is needed, and more importantly, to underline the overwhelmingly positive contributions of migrants, even in countries that are affected by the economic downturn, because again, those migrants are usually filling some of the jobs that the nationals do not want to fill. And those countries also need highly skilled migrants, simply because in today's world of mobility, European countries, for instance, are also losing some of their skilled, qualified young professionals who are going global and finding jobs elsewhere outside of Europe.
That was Jean-Philippe Chauzy with the International Organization for Migration discussing the plight of migrants. Today, the UN marks the 22nd annual International Migrants Day. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Shauna Ray and George Lavender. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.